Housing and Family Security Committee will come to order. We're going to begin with Senator Scheid's bill, which would normally be just a very routine thing because it came back from the floor at the end of session, but I understand you have an amendment, so welcome to the committee. Senate File 1761.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And this bill, members may recall, had to do with how health plans classify oral chemotherapy versus intravenous chemotherapy. And there are oral chemotherapy represents a rather small portion of the kind of chemotherapy that's available, but there are some very significant drugs that have been developed that people may take orally rather than by infusion. And just from personal experience, it sure would have been nice. And there, I think you have a letter that that I signed on the top. I don't know if we need to do that for committees or not, but I just from the Minnesota Ovarian Cancer Alliance, and it does, I think, a very good job of explaining to you that some of the drugs that may be taken orally today are as effective in eliminating cancer cells without harming other healthy cells. And that is so important. When I was going through my first round of chemotherapy, I remember people thinking that, I had somebody say to me, I thought we were losing you. And what it was a side effect. It was the beating up of my red blood cells and my white blood cells. And it wasn't that the cancer was getting me. It was the side effects that were pounding away at my system and having other impacts on other kinds of cells that reproduce much like cancer cells. So if you can have a drug that you can take without having those kinds of things happen to you, then, and I'd encourage you to read the larger paragraph there because I think it says it all, where a patient, it's a situation where a patient had recurrent ovarian cancer. And the good news is, there are probably medical people in the room who would disagree with me, but I thank heaven for recurrent ovarian cancer because it means, it used to be much more of a death sentence, and now they treat it much more like a chronic condition. And so when you have a recurrence, there are usually drugs you can opt for that can get you through that recurrence and get you back to normal, in remission, if you will. No evidence of disease, and that's a good thing. So this person was recommended to have a treatment, but it was going to cost her $8,500 out of pocket. The difference is how the plans treat the oral chemo versus the intravenous. One comes under the medical treatment category. That would be the intravenous. You pay your regular, office visit copay. And those are not inexpensive either. I don't know if you call it the rack rate, but not the contracted rate, but I've seen of some of the chemotherapy I received, just a portion, one piece of the treatment was $11,000, and that was one treatment. That wasn't for the course of treatment. That was one day. And so and what they're doing is treating the oral chemotherapy under the prescription benefit. So this, and I guess I would like to ask you, the amendment, I think, improves the bill. The one substantive piece of the amendment, excuse me, that it's in the section parens B on line 1.11 of the A1 amendment, and that is that the health plans could not counteract what we're doing with the oral chemotherapy by increasing the copayments, deductibles, or coinsurance for an intravenously or injected cancer chemotherapy agent. So, and again, if I could ask somebody to move that.
Senator Coring moves the A1 amendment. And And my understanding was that in Oregon or someplace where they passed a bill like this, what they were doing was just, if it was $8,500 copayment for the outpatient, they were just putting an $8,500 copayment for the inpatient too, or for the intravenous one too.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't know if I've heard that. This was a Minnesota.
Right. I'm person. Just asking if that's the
I
way.
I heard that they weren't. That it, Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry. I heard or I understand that they have not had an increase in premiums. Because I think the plans say this is not really a mandate. I mean, we're not mandating new coverage. It's being covered. We're just saying, you know, and there are some drugs that are available in both forms. And frankly, for someone who lives in greater Minnesota, to be able to take the form of the drug orally rather than intravenously may make a whole world of difference, because there are certain people that, you know, certain nurses who take care of the infusion, and that's very, very technical and is done by people who have had specific training for doing that. So I think in some ways you're saving costs for that patient, and if they would have to come in, for example, to the Twin Cities or get into Duluth or whatever to have an infusion, it might be better. It certainly would be better to be able to take a pill.
Senator, on the A1 amendment, we'll incorporate on line 16, change the word appropriation to appropriate. On Senator Coring's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Shah, you've got some witnesses.
Mr. Chairman, I think they are here. Did I say anything inaccurate? No. Okay. I think who's going to go first. Okay. Dr. Tom Flynn is going to be the first witness.
Welcome to the committee, Dr. Flynn.
Thank you very much. Dr. Tom Flynn, here as part of a practice of oncologists known as Minnesota Oncology. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you much for the opportunity to discuss this important legislation with you, important to cancer patients in Minnesota. I've been a practicing oncologist for 25 years here in Minnesota, actually more than 25 years, and have seen many advances in cancer care, significant advances in chemotherapy particularly, and the latest of these represents the development of new targeted therapies, which are often delivered in an oral form. The portion of oncology drugs that are currently oral agents is only about 10%. However, certainly all the projections from our national societies and experience across the country would indicate that these will increase to probably 25% of oncology drugs by 2013. These oral agents currently, for some cancers, are not only the best available treatment, but they may, in fact, be the only treatment that's available for certain malignancies in certain situations. The difficulty, as Senator Scheid indicated, is that these medications are often reimbursed on a different part of the patient's medical insurance coverage, such that their out-of-pocket costs are substantially higher for these agents. Patients may have to make choices about treatment options based on the amount of cost that they're going to have to endure. And we don't think certainly that cancer patients should have to do that, but rather work with their physicians to determine the best course of treatment for their disease, and not put in a situation where a difference in out-of-pocket cost is so substantial that they are, having to choose a less effective or no treatment because of the cost. We certainly expect that these agents will become a more significant issue in cancer treatment just in the next few years, so it's important that we address this issue now before the problem gets more difficult. So on behalf of the cancer patients that it's our privilege to serve here in Minnesota, I ask you to support this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Flynn. Questions from the committee? Mr. Ahrens, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Ahrens, Director of Government Relations for the American Cancer Society in Minnesota. Briefly, the Cancer Society is an organization of cancer patients, survivors, and caregivers. We care very deeply about this bill and believe it's the right thing to do so that more Minnesotans Once they hear those dreadful words, "You have cancer," we'll know that they're going to have the best treatment available to them at a price they can afford. As Dr. Flynn pointed out, if we do not do something to lift the cost burden off cancer patients under private health insurance today, we're simply going to be back here year in and year out, because the cost differential between patients who have been prescribed by their doctor for traditional intravenous chemotherapy and the medicine that their doctor believes is the best for them for oral cancer chemotherapy is a big difference. There's a big difference in what patients are paying in out-of-pocket costs. We do not believe that copays, deductibles, and coinsurance should present access to care barriers. Rather, they should represent cost sharing that is appropriate in terms of utilization. Minnesota has a great healthcare system in many ways, particularly compared to other states. And thanks to your leadership on this committee, we're trying to fix the parts of our healthcare system, public and private, that need fixing. Here's one of those parts of the private healthcare system that needs some additional work, so that we can make sure cancer patients are able to afford the cancer medicines they need. As cancer medicine evolves, so too must our health insurance systems that ensure people are paying the right price, not a price that they can't afford, creating an access problem. Oral chemotherapy medicines offer hope in that they are very targeted to particular types of cancers. We want to make sure that they're able to afford these medicines in a way that doesn't force choices between paying for a mortgage and paying for cancer treatment. Simply put, we hope that you help us equalize these out-of-pocket cost burdens that we were trying to do through health care reform. And, of course, the health care reform debate is not over, but we're very hopeful that we can continue with policies at the federal and state level to lift the cost burden on patients. We ask for your support, and thank you very much for hearing what we have to say today. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Questions from the committee. Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Scheid, there are other diseases that have treatments that come along that might be oral in nature as opposed to other kinds of treatments that are also very expensive. And I'm wondering, why would we want to single out cancer treatment as opposed to all the other diseases that have, I mean, we've had other people come in front of this committee even. MS, for example, very expensive drugs. So why would we want to do this for cancer and not do it for the others?
Mr. Chairman? Mr. Chairman and Senator Berglund, actually I have a bill that the MS Society is promoting concerning biologics, and that's, I don't think that these drugs are necessarily biologics. I don't know if any of them are or not, but
a portion are.
Some are. Cancer is the number one killer in Minnesota. You know, it's not heart disease in Minnesota anymore. I think that's true, been true for a couple of years here. And the bill was brought to me by the American Cancer Society, and so I guess that's why we're moving in that direction. I can understand that there may be other conditions where there'd be a choice between an oral agent, you know, an oral form of medication and an intravenous. I don't know what they are.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Scheid, I just raise it because I think, you know, we need to have a consistent policy, and if we're going to do it for one, we probably should do it for others as well. And I know the arguments that we've heard in the past is that the others is that traditionally health insurance does charge more for treatments that cost more. And that's even true for lower cost drugs. They're tiered formularies, and if you need a brand name drug, it might be the only drug there is that will treat the condition you have. You have a higher copay because the drug costs more. And so I'm not sure if we should be moving entirely away from that principle or not.
I don't know if you want to say anything. Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Mr.
Senator Berglund. I can only speak for cancer patients, and I completely respect your job in terms of trying to create the right policy for the state of Minnesota. The reason we support this bill is because we are being reported by cancer patients that they are facing really high out-of-pocket costs for this new species of medicines, some for which there is no IV substitute. And that is why we support this bill. I understand you're trying to set policy. In the cancer world, we're trying to make sure cancer patients have lower out-of-pocket costs so they can access the medicines. And there's a lot of cost issues here, as particularly the health plans we'll talk about.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Ahrens, you have your job to do. You're doing your job. We also have our job to do. And our job, we aren't always doing everybody a favor by saying yes to everything that comes along that affects people that have health conditions, because pretty soon we have a policy that's unsustainable financially.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, may Dr. Flynn make a comment, please.
I think Senator Berglund's, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think Senator Berglund's comments are certainly very well taken. I think, though, that in the particular instance of cancer treatment, which is what I know and what I do, we see many instances where there are some newer therapies that are intravenous in form and are fully covered under a medical benefit, where the patient only has a copay that is relatively small for the office visit. And yet, if they are going to be treated with an oral medication, the treatment as a total cost to the system may actually be less than the intravenous form, but they are in a position where they have to pay substantially more out of pocket. Thank you.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Chairman and Doctor, is that true in every case?
Is it?
Is that true in every case that the medication is cheaper than the other treatment available?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, no, not in every case.
Then maybe we should make the policy apply only in cases where it is.
That's certainly a policy issue that I'm not the expert to answer.
Further questions for these witnesses? Not. Thank
Mr.
you very
much.
Senator Torres-Rabe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Scheid, I am concerned about the whole issue of how the actual treatment may not be offered as a result of this to the patient. In other words, how, if we put this restriction, I am concerned that, and please correct me if I am mistaken by thinking that this may happen, that if the copay is unequal, if the health plan is not able to charge for the treatment that is more expensive, then that treatment may not be offered to that patient because they will just simply say they cannot recover that cost. Do you think that that could be an unintended consequence of this, that the health plan may not offer that treatment because the health plan knows this is more expensive, then they are not able to make the copay, they recover that through copay, therefore they do not offer it? So two things occur to me, that if that is the case, you know, we might need to amend this if we support this so that that doesn't happen, but could it happen?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Torres-Rae, I think that has happened over the years in a number of kinds of treatments that have been suggested or recommended by a physician, and plans have resisted paying, and sometimes they've been taken to court and decided to pay. I mean, I don't know if that's what you're saying here, because I think I also know that the plans also have a committee or some kind of an entity within the plan that determines what the efficacy of certain treatments. And if you have something that you know is effective and you won't cover it because the copay is different, that just... I just don't see the plans going, going in that direction. I mean, I think that's unconscionable. So,
well, thank you.
I'm not sure that that's what you're asking, but
I will ask. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I will ask the question as well to the people who are testifying next.
The other side, Senator Berglund.
Yes. Mr. Chairman and Senator Scheid, I think you're right. They probably wouldn't say we're not going to offer this cancer drug, but they might say we're going to place a cap on total benefits that we will cover. This is not unheard of. It's done in policies all the time. We'll pay up to this much, and then we're not going to pay anything anymore.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, that's effectively happening now if there that a treatment is not available to a patient because of the way it's dealt with by the plan, because it's under a different kind of coverage than the intravenous. But and there are costs that you can't configure in here that have to do with the cost to the patient, particularly those in Greater Minnesota, for example. But they're making progress with the oral drugs, and I think that, an awful lot of cost goes into my counteracting some of the effects of intravenous chemotherapy. And I can tell you that if you have a shot of Neulasta or Aranesp, it's very pricey. Those are the kinds of things that it's the kind of things that support. Now, I don't know. Maybe you need that kind of stuff with oral. Apparently not. I mean, that is a really big deal. There are a lot of costs associated with dealing with side effects of infusion chemotherapy or infused chemotherapy. So, I just think that this, it makes so much sense. It, particularly when you have a drug that's available in both forms. Now, most are not, but why would you, and you're treating something the same way, but you may have less negative impact with one over the other, why wouldn't you as a patient choose that, and why wouldn't the plans want their insureds, to have that that option? So, I can't sit here and prove. I don't have a spreadsheet to show you the varying costs with intravenous chemotherapy, but I know they're way beyond the drug itself, the drugs themselves. Because when you get intravenous chemotherapy, you get steroids, you get stuff for nausea, you get all kinds of different things that you would never have thought were involved in getting, for example, the Taxol or whatever the drug is that's actually going to do the work against the cancer cells. So this, I think, taking a pill just would be most people's first choice if it's available, and they are going to become increasingly available. We're just trying to sort out what I think is an inconsistency in how the plans deal with them.
Senator Lurie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Scheid, one thing as I'm thinking through this that concerns me, I'd like to get your reaction to it. I mean, a possible unintended consequence of doing this would be one of the groups that's not coming forward to the table here is Big Pharma, and it has a huge impact on them. One of the big issues here is they're charging too darn much for these drugs. And so if we require this, then they're going to be able to sell their drugs broader, and it's maybe going to help them keep those prices high rather than putting some pressure on them. If they can't sell their drugs because they don't get paid and they don't get used, it keeps some pressure. I don't know. I'm just thinking aloud here and would appreciate your thoughts on whether there might be a perverse incentive built into a proposal like this for pharmaceutical companies to keep their drug prices high by mandating that they get paid at that level.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman?
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I think we're all aware of when a new drug comes on the market, it's generally much more expensive, and eventually most of them become available as a generic, and the price goes down. If you're using something more, I think the inclination would be for the price to come down. I mean, that's perverse, what you're suggesting, but that would have been true all along. I mean, with any new drug, I think. And I think that what we've seen is that they generally become less expensive as they're more used.
Why don't we have the witnesses from the other side testify? I'll remind the committee, we did pass this bill last year. It just bounced back because it was on the floor. We wouldn't be spending all this time, but there was an amendment to it. So why don't we have the opposition witnesses come?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Catherine Commit. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. The council represents 7 nonprofit health plans here in Minnesota. And I'm going to be brief with my testimony. I do have a copy of a letter with the points that I wanted to make today about this legislation. Let me just cut to the chase. I would just want to remind everybody that health plans do cover cancer treatment, and specifically to Representative, Senator Torres Ray question about would there be treatments that the health plans wouldn't cover. No, that's not accurate. If the physician determines that that's the appropriate course of treatment for cancer, especially cancer, where there have been so many clinical trials that have been performed and there's a real wealth of science and knowledge and evidence to show that certain medications are, in fact, effective, the health plan will cover that. I think what this bill is doing is looking at how to equalize the cost sharing for the enrollee when it is an oral medication versus an IV or infusion therapy type of medication. But I want to make sure everyone understands that the health plans do cover oral chemotherapy as well as infusion and IV therapy for patients who are battling cancer. Another thing that's already come up is that chemotherapy is very, very expensive. And some of the new oral chemotherapy medications are absolutely wonder drugs. They also cost a lot of money. One drug in particular, Revlimid, costs about $72,000 a year. When we're talking about the cost sharing, I want to be clear that people understand that it's going to be based, whatever the cost sharing is going to be based on the type of policy that the employer has purchased on behalf of the employee or the patient. And so typically in the fully insured market, typical health plans are often have a $3,000 out-of-pocket maximum, $5,000 family out-of-pocket maximum. That's not always the case, however. It's, again, going to depend on what the employer purchased for his or her employees. What this is, and as Senator Scheid mentioned, this is really about how these treatments are costed out based on where they're delivered. This bill could actually result in patients paying more out-of-pocket costs because typically there are straight 80-20 cost-sharing arrangements for people who have get infusion therapy or IV therapy, and so it could actually be more than the capped amount over on the prescription drug side. Again, that's going to vary based on the type of coverage that individual enrollee has. And then, you know, I think bottom line is that the passage of this bill will simply place upward pressure on premiums. It's really just pushing it down at the out-of-pocket cost-sharing level and will put more of the pressure or increase the cost more in the premiums. And I know that my colleague Cecilia Rattel from the Chamber of Commerce is going to speak more about that. But I guess if I can leave you with anything is just to say that this is an issue of how to share the costs of very expensive treatment between the purchaser, the employer, and the patient. This is really about who pays the bill. And it's a balancing act. The more invisible the cost is to the patient, the more the employer will have to pay. If you pass this bill, you are making the decision to shift more of the cost of healthcare to the employer. And there is no easy answer here. Either decision you make today will have consequences. And we've discussed our concerns with Senator Scheid as well as Mr. Ahrens at the Cancer Society. We would be happy to keep working with them on trying to find a solution to this issue. But at this time, we must oppose the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Committee. Questions from the committee? Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Ms. Commit. And I presume you heard some of the testimony earlier, and I wanted to ask specifically, are there treatments that use the same drug, but in some cases intravenously, in some cases orally, and are there different copays for treating using the same medication in a different form? Do the copays differ, to your knowledge? I'm trying to find out.
Mr. Chair and Senator Hahn, I don't know exactly, but I would say that in practice that's probably the case. If you're getting the exact same chemical equivalent, either in a pill form that you would get if you were having it infused or receiving it through an IV, you would have a different copay structure because the treatment that you're getting in the clinic or the inpatient hospital setting is going to be treated as a medical benefit versus the prescription drug benefit. And they just have different underlying cost structures that drive what those enrollee cost sharing amounts are.
And Mr. Chairman and Ms. Commit, so just so that I'm clear that, and I read in your letter that sometimes that's a difficult comparison to make because you may get the same treatment, but if you do it intravenously or through some injection, it might be a larger dose all at once. If you do it orally, it may extend over some period of time. And so there may be some differences in the method of administration that could drive cost. I understand that. But are there significant differences in copays between those two things, or is it not significant? And I know it's a judgment call, but I'm just asking.
Senator Marty and Senator Hahn, I don't know the answer, but I can find that out for you. I think what's important to remember is that there is a cap on out-of-pocket cost sharing. So we didn't talk too much about that when the bill was being presented, but typically it's in the neighborhood of, it could be $3,000, could be $5,000. Again, it's dependent on what kind of a insurance package that enrollee has, typically purchased by their employer on their behalf. And I will say, too, that I think the example in the letter from the Ovarian Cancer Society may actually refer to, I don't know for sure, but that seems awfully excessive to have an $8,500 copay or out-of-pocket cost sharing. I'm wondering if that might be a self-funded plan where this bill would not have any impact on anyone who's covered under a larger employer where they have a self-funded plan.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Ms. Commit. Again, I'm just trying to clarify this in my mind. Is the point of your objection that taking a medication orally through a prescription is a certain kind of treatment, going and getting an infusion or an injection, is something different? And so is the point that you're making that in the bill we're trying to conflate apples and oranges, if you will, and treat them identically in terms of how those copay costs are administered? Is that the point that you're trying to make, that doesn't work and we ought not to try to conflate those things but to treat them as separate mechanisms? Is that what you're getting at?
Senator Marty and Senator Hahn, I think that, yes, you're touching on that's accurate. It's really a bigger issue of deciding how are these benefits administered and organized. Again, the IV or infusion are considered a medical benefit and treated as such. There are different underlying cost structures. The person might have to go to the clinic where there are nurses and other medical personnel there overseeing the patient's course of treatment and that sort of thing, which is different from being prescribed a pill so that they can go home and take that pill on their own. And it's going to vary drug to drug. Some require more management, where you have to have your blood pressure taken or you're in there in the office three times a week or something like that versus just taking an oral medication.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Commit, I'm just wondering, if you've got to take an oral drug and you can take it at home, versus going into the doctor for intravenous with all the expenses that go into going into to see the doctor? Wouldn't they kind of balance each other out as far as overall cost to the system? So why would the health plans object to this particular proposal?
Senator Marty and Senator Dell, good question. It's not that we don't object to the medication, that the oral medication. We want people to be taking these drugs. It vastly improves their quality of life. It extends their life. And the health plans pay for that. In the particular example of Revlimid, that's a medication that's available as an oral medication, $72,000 a year. There's going to be a cap for that patient. So most, 95% or upwards of 90% of the drug is already going to be paid. There's a small cost sharing, and it's going to be capped by their out-of-pocket maximum. If it's the will of the legislature to change this law and say you have to have parity between these two types of benefits, then that's going to just shift where those additional costs are, because those costs aren't going away. They're still going to be there. It's just going to become have to be factored in more as part of the overall premium, which means shifting more of the pressure to the employer who is already struggling to pay their cost of health insurance right now.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Questions. Go ahead.
Okay, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Cecilia Rattel, and I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I'm looking around. I recognize some of you, but I look forward to meeting the rest of you hopefully sometime soon. The Minnesota Chamber represents 2,400 businesses throughout the state of Minnesota. We're concerned that enactment of this bill will lead to increased costs at a time when employers and individuals are struggling to maintain health care coverage. Employers want to do well by their employees, but the downturned economy, employers are having to decide between laying people off to keep health care coverage for others or keep as many people as possible but drop coverage. These decisions are very difficult. Last month, the Minnesota Department of Health reported that our uninsured rate increased from 480,000 Minnesotans, or 9.1%, in 2009, which is an increase from 374,000 Minnesotans, or 7.2%, in 2007. The Department of Health also recently reported that Minnesotans who work at companies with 2 to 10 employers now represent 28% of people who are employed but uninsured. That's up from 22% in 2007. When compared to employers of all sizes, employees in the 2 to 10 group were the most likely to lose their coverage. You should all have this pie chart in your packets, and this is from the 2007 numbers, so like the uninsured, that's now 9.1%. That hasn't been updated yet. But if this bill were enacted, it would only apply to this group here, which is the fully insured, which is roughly 27%, give or take a couple percentage points. In Minnesota, that's because state laws and regulations only apply to products in the fully insured market, which are typically purchased by small employers and individuals. 41% of the population is covered by large self-funded employers that are exempt from state laws and regulations due to the federal ERISA laws. This bill will increase the cost of coverage for everyone in the fully insured market, and this bill will limit the ability of health plans to continue to use the tools necessary to help curb costs, including enrollee cost-sharing levels. Clearly, more must be done to contain health care costs. This bill focuses on the financing, and by reducing the cost of oral chemotherapy drugs, it increases the cost of insurance for employers. It is for this reason that we oppose this bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Corrin.
I'm tired yet from last night, the bonding committee. But I guess I, here again, I'm not a college guy, even though I'm taking some college classes now to try to be as smart as everybody else here. But I don't understand why this is going to cost more, why the chamber thinks it's going to cost more to the businesses. I guess I'm puzzled by that. And then I guess another question: does the chamber has the chamber weighed in on the GAMC fix that's been proposed here in the legislature?
Mr. Chair and Senator Coring, for the GAMC fix, we have not weighed in at this point. We are neutral at this point, And to your question regarding this bill, the reason that it only applies to the businesses is because the businesses that we represent more are the fully insured, not the bigger corporations such as Target or 3M that are full or self-insured. So they are exempt from any mandates, and that's the 41% down here. Does that answer your question?
Mm, I still don't. I still don't understand what's going on.
I'll take a crack. Senator Marty and Senator Coring. The reason it's going to cost more is because if we passage of this bill will cap what it can be shared, the cost that can be shared with the enrollee for these for cancer.
Can you just give me an example of, let's say, person X, and how is that going to, if they're taking an intravenous drug, but the pills will work better for them, or can you give me an example of how? I guess I need to understand.
Typically, what happens, Senator Coring, is that if a person is prescribed an oral chemotherapy medication, they may have a higher copay than what they would get for, say, an antibiotic or something like that. It might be in the neighborhood of $200 per prescription. Typically, a prescription is a 30-day prescription. So that is more money than what you would pay for an ear infection or something. Mm-hmm. However, under that person's health insurance policy, which will vary depending on what kind of a policy they have, they will have a cap on the out-of-pocket costs. And what this bill seeks to do is to limit that cost sharing for the enrollee so that the costs they can't be more or than what is being required for drugs that are taken at the doctor's office or in an inpatient hospital setting by infusion or IV. The cost of the medication doesn't go away. It just means that enrollee cost sharing will be limited, but then the cost is going to have to be shifted somewhere, and typically that's going to be shifted to the employer's premium.
Okay. How do we know, Mr. Chairman, how do we know that it's going to be shifted? We just automatically assume that it'll be shifted, the cost. Okay.
Mr. Chair, I wanted to, I'm sorry.
Senator Higgins on that point.
Mr. Chair, and Ms. Commit, it sounds like you're comparing the oral chemotherapy drugs to an antibiotic and the cost of that. And what it should be being compared with is the other types of chemotherapy. And so would you like to reframe your answer, please, comparing the different types of the chemotherapy and the costs rather than moving the direction in a way that this bill does not go?
Certainly, and I apologize for that not being clear.
No, it was clear, but could you try to talk about apples and apples is what I'm trying to say.
Certainly. I apologize. One of the things that even concerns us about this legislation, an unintended consequence that I think could happen is that if you put a cap on the oral chemotherapy, let's say your cap is let's just say it's $300 a month. So that's what that cost would be, that out-of-pocket cost would be for that oral chemotherapy drug. But if you go to the doctor's office or the outpatient setting and you receive an infusion or IV therapy and the benefit structure there is on an 80-20 basis, let's say that drug costs $100,000, that 80-20 cost sharing for the patient might actually be higher than what it is for the oral chemotherapy. You could have that unintended consequence occurring where it could actually be higher.
Mr. Chair,
I don't think that's the intent of this legislation.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Commit, is there any chemotherapy that's $100,000 for an individual treatment?
We'd have to bring up the doctor, I think, and ask him.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, then that's happening today. I mean, the intravenous chemotherapy that I've received is very, very expensive.
Okay.
And
I just didn't know.
So I just don't, you know, the state of Oregon, and I don't know how they compare to us. I know we compare real well to Washington State, but I'm not sure about Oregon. But they have this legislation. I don't know if it's verbatim, but they have not seen an increase, a difference, because there are other costs associated with the intravenous that you can't figure into a direct comparison.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Dowling-Torres-Rate.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to take another stab at this, though. So we've got a drug that could cost up to $72,000 a year if it's taken orally. But we could also have $72,000 in intravenous drugs and the visits to the doctor. So they're the same price, both of them at the end of the year. But the problem is right now is that there's a higher copay for the oral chemotherapy. And so because this would change that would cost, actually, it would cost more to the plans or to whoever's paying for the plan, because currently it's not treated the same as those other therapies, even though the cost overall is the same. It's just treated differently. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dahl, that is one possibility. There's another possibility where the cost, if they were actually the same cost, either oral or an IV therapy, it could actually be more for the IV therapy because there's an 80-20 cost-sharing arrangement going on, and that's not happening under the prescription drug benefit.
Okay.
Senator Torres-Rae, Senator Breedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Scheid, so when you receive treatment, the cost, I think we've all asked the same question. I just guess I want to hear a very straightforward answer.
Okay.
The cost of this medication is basically the same, but you were charged a lot more because of the treatment option that you received, or were the cost of the medication actually very different?
Mr. Chairman, I don't want you to think that I've been offered an oral drug and had to opt for the intravenous, because I didn't have that option. My chemotherapy has been intravenous almost exclusively. So I guess I was making the point that there are other costs associated with that drug and that treatment, that and there are other drugs involved other than the chemotherapy agent itself.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Scheid, I guess, you might not be a good patient for this because you haven't done both. But I guess my question then continues to be the same. I don't know if you have an answer for this. But so the cost of the medication is basically the same. The treatment is different, and this is where the cost of the actual treatment that includes the medication then is so different. Is that what ultimately happens?
Mr. Chairman, if I might, I think I don't think I'm saying that the cost is the same. It certainly isn't in all cases. Some of the oral chemotherapy is very, very expensive. It's very, very new, very, very expensive, very effective perhaps, and also doesn't have the side effects. But it could be. I'm sure there are oral chemotherapy agents that may be about the same. I'm not here suggesting. I don't have a spreadsheet, as I said, to show you, you know, this intravenous agent versus this oral drug. So, but it could be. And in any case, those are issues today if people are getting intravenous chemotherapy.
Yeah.
You know, as on their treatment, they're 80-20. I mean, that's not something that we're creating here. That's already occurring, if I understand what Ms. Smith said.
Thank you,
Senator Berglund, and sir.
Senator Scheid, you said that this bill had been passed in Oregon, was it, or Washington State?
Mr. Chairman, in Oregon.
Mm-hmm. And you said that it didn't raise the cost of the premiums there. How long ago was it passed?
Mr. Chairman, may I ask Mr. Ahrens to respond?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, about 2 years ago, and to the best of our knowledge, Oregon health plans have not raised premiums as a result of this legislation. 2 years ago. Mr. Chair, Senator Scheid's question to me was, have other states passed this law? To the best of my knowledge, Oregon is the only one, but several others are considering the same law, same legislation.
Senator Hickey, again. Senator Hand.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I noticed Ms. Commit just left the table, and I was going to ask her another question. Could I indulge the committee for a moment? Sorry, Mr. Hickey, we'll get to you, I'm sure, in a minute. And Mr. Chairman and Ms. Commit, I'm trying to, again, just clarify, and I know there's been a number of questions around this same thing, but I want to tell you what I understand this. You correct me. As I understand this, we've got, in the healthcare world, there you can have drug benefits, and then you have treatment benefits, and the structures to share the costs between the patient and the provider and the insurer are different. Those structures of sharing are different from drug benefits versus treatments. Is that generally correct? And as I understand this, in cancer treatment, you could have a treatment that is pill-based, drug-based, I guess, orally administered, versus a treatment that is being done some other way. And as I take it, your point is that those things are hard to compare because the plans call for a different structure of sharing the costs among those three entities. Am I getting that correct? Is that a fair way to say that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Hand, yes, I think you're getting that right.
And so thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Commit. Then the further question I would have is the language of the bill itself is calling for, with respect to treating of cancer, a similar patient cost, if you will, which in your argument means that some of that cost structure is going to have to be shifted somewhere else, and you're arguing it's going to end up with the employer or whoever pays for the plan. Are there other treatments? Do we have other statutes that direct plans to treat copays like this for other kinds of treatments, or is this the only? Would this be a unique directive from the legislature?
Senator Marty and Senator Hand, thank you for the question. Yes, or I should say, you are correct that this would be the first law on the books that would say you have to do this differently for this particular kind of condition. So the enrollee cost sharing would be different for persons with cancer. As Senator Berglund mentioned earlier, there was legislation last year that looked at this issue as it related to the coverage of MS drugs, or cost sharing, I should say, of MS drugs. But that bill was defeated in this committee last year. And let me just also make sure everyone understands that typically these oral chemotherapy drugs are brand new medications that are different and aren't typically available as as something that you can also get through an infusion or IV. It's something different, and they are typically, as Senator Scheid had mentioned, called biologics, which are built or are developed out of living organisms. They're wonderful drugs, very difficult to manufacture, but do some marvelous things, and they are not eligible for going generic. And that's something that's a proposal that was in the federal health care reform legislation to begin that process of allowing biologics to become generic medications at some point. But they're very, very expensive.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I'm so glad I have a bill back before you that, you know, I'm sorry that there's an amendment. I wish we could just have voted back out. The committee did pass it last year. The only substantive change is, I think, the language that has to do with the plans not being able to, if they have to reduce the copay on the oral drug, not being able to raise the copay on the treatment. That's the substantive piece, I think, of the amendment. Otherwise, it just, I think, is better worded than we had the bill last year. So,
yes. Do we have a motion? Senator Torres-Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Scheid, I really appreciate that you are bringing this before us again. And you do have my support, although I understand the complexities of this. And that's why I'm asking all of these questions. But fundamentally, I believe that you are trying to make sure that patients and people are the bottom line here. And I think that that is clear to me with your proposal. And so that's why I am supporting you. So the question for us as legislators and what is evident here is ultimately who has to pay for it, right? And so what we're concerned about is obviously if the health plans have to pay for it, which is kind of not really fair, they are going to raise premiums, which is really not fair. And so ultimately the patient pays. And that is why I wish the Chamber of Commerce, instead of coming and saying, oh, only 20%, will come and say, this is a proposal that we will support for universal coverage for everyone so that no one has to do this. But they haven't. So it is only 20%. It is only a portion. It is shifting costs. That is healthcare at its best today. At the end, people like you who have gone through this pay the bill, and many cannot afford it. So I just wanted to say that to you because I think that you deserve our support, and I thank you for this. And this is very complicated. It is not easy for us as legislators to come here and say, well, you don't pay for it, then you pay for it, then you don't, and I do. Well, ultimately, all of you are our constituents, and ultimately, all of our constituents are paying for it. So I know you're trying to fix that, and thank you for that.
Do you want to move the bill?
I do.
Senator Torres-Reed moves Senate File 1761 as amended be recommended to pass. Is there further discussion? Mr. Hickey had not testified. That's right. I'm sorry. Yeah, I saw you come up there and saw you leave. When. Go ahead and testify.
Mr. Chairman, I was just going to defer to Catherine Schmidt, but you know, I appreciate a chance to make a few brief comments. Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business. We're the state's largest small business group. We are the group the most affected by these mandates. Virtually none of our members are self-insured, and so our members are feeling the full brunt of all of Minnesota's mandates. Members, we have a terrible recession going on. Everybody's very concerned about the high cost of health care, but we continue to see mandating A through Z. I believe we had eight that were considered last year, and this is a very compelling mandate and a very compelling situation. Some aren't. This one is certainly more compelling. But we just can't afford it any longer. Everybody knows we're impacting very few people, about 27% of the total insurance pool with these mandates, about maybe 40% of the private sector. But these are the people who can at least afford it. And we just can't keep doing this. There are some real concerns about expensive but helpful drugs that will now be included and could really grow cost, explode cost. And it's just a real problem. We just have to stop mandating and look at better solutions. But we just keep seeing this, and I just want to let you know that this is not going to help anybody provide health insurance for their members or hang on to it. And we just got to stop mandating, and I know we're really struggling with this one, but the situation's the same for all of these, even though this is more compelling. And I appreciate the time.
Thank you, Mr. Hickey. Question, Senator Dow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hickey, thank you. But I want one question for you. Do you think if we don't put any mandates on anymore, everything stayed the same, do you think premiums will remain the same next year or they'll go up? In your opinion, based on just the past 10 years?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dahl, concern about health care costs is the big issue in the United States. We have the world's most advanced health care system, but we're also really struggling with cost. We're worried cost is going to go up, period, just due to the whole system. But these mandates obviously just make it worse.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I bring that up because I see that California, I don't know if they have this bill and are mandating this, but I think one of their plans out there is going to raise premiums 38% on their individual policies. So I don't know if it's the mandates that are doing it or it's something else, but we also have to consider, you know, what's the overall quality of the system as we're looking at controlling costs and is it delivering the type of health care that we want, and if individuals can get this service and it's spread out across, even if it's just 26%, it maybe raises the premium by a quarter of 1%. And we're actually going to see a 9 or 10%. It might. I think most people will probably find that that's worthwhile. I don't know. I don't know that it will. I think that's the fear that it might, but I don't know that we've heard anything yet that it will actually raise the premiums.
Mr. Chairman, if I might just say.
Mr. Higgins.
I'm sorry.
Oh, go ahead, Senator Shad.
Well, I just want to say this isn't, I mean, I suppose technically you would call it a mandate because we're instructing the plans to do something, but it's not a new service. It's not we're requiring them to cover something new. They're already covering the oral medication. They're just covering it in a different area. And in some cases, the same drug is available in both forms, and you would pay differently. And I guess I do want to say something about the types of cancer for which the oral drugs are now available. I mean, it isn't for every cancer, and it probably isn't for every stage or of every individual's particular type of cancer. But blood cancers, breast cancer, colon cancer, and ovarian cancer are apparently, and I know breast and colon cancer happen with greater incidence in parts of our population. I understand that a lot of people may not even be able to afford any insurance and are currently uninsured who are in those populations. It just underscores how we have to have reform. It's not fair that access to effective health care that can save your life is out of reach for some people. So I think this is an important bill, but I also support underlying reform so that everybody has access there.
That's key. Mr. Hickey, then Senator Hand, then I think we might be ready for a vote.
Oh. Mr. Chairman, Senator Dahl, I just want to respond back. Everybody agrees cost is a huge problem here, but how is this helping? I mean, no, we don't know what the exact amount of the increase is going to be. People fear it could be bad when you look at the cost of some of these drugs on annual cost basis. So, I mean, this just can't be helping. It's helping out certain people in certain situations, but for small employers struggling to continue to provide that premium, this is not helping, clearly.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe for Senator Scheid, a question. Would your bill be better if in that A paragraph we said something like that the health plan company that provides coverage for cancer chemotherapy treatment should not require a copayment deductible coinsurance amount greater than $20? If that were the bill, would that be better? Would that accomplish your end? If we I'm just picking a number, $20, maybe it's $50, but if we said, well, we're going to set the copayment for cancer treatment, whether it's chemotherapy or otherwise, to be X, would that be a better solution?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I haven't done the math, and I certainly am in no position to say that, but I suspect not. The issue here is drugs that destroy or interfere with the reproduction of cancer cells. And some do it more effectively than others in certain patients, and the patients ought to have the option and be able to afford the option. There ought not to be a difference in the price for having that option of choosing something that may have less side effects and actually less, I don't know if the word's ancillary, costs that are associated with the side effects that are not even taken into consideration here. I think
we'll find
not.
Cheaper.
You know, maybe I'd probably say that it probably just ought to be available to people, and people pay what they can afford to pay, and that everybody ought to have access to the same drug. I mean, if in a perfect world.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Scheid, I guess that was kind of my point. As I'm trying to sort through this, it seems as if there are costs for medical treatment, and they're different depending on what we do. And all of us, I think, recognize that it would be wonderful if patients did not have to pay much. And I understand that. I'm certainly, in my own world, like to see low payments as well. But But then it gets to, I think, the point that Senator Dahl was making or others were asking about. Then those costs get paid somewhere else. And so if we say, well, we're going to say the price for a copayment or the patient's share of a particular treatment is going to be some amount, whether we fix it or whether we do as your bill suggests, then someone else will pay that amount. What I'm struggling with is how we are able as a committee to determine the cost structures to find out whether that makes, whether that's really truly sensible. I mean, I get your point that if the costs really are the same, then the copayments really should be the same. But it's not clear to me that the costs are really the same. And that's where I'm not sure if I'm competent enough to know in the drug world and the cancer treatment world and the cost structures of those various things and to be able to say, well, I know where that cost ought to be, and so therefore I'm able to decide what the price ought to be. But that's, as I understand it, what we're asking to do here, or what we're being asked to do with this legislation, is to pick a price in some way. And I'm not sure how we can do that unless we understand what those cost structures really look like, and that may take a lot of work and maybe a lengthy presentation on the part of a lot of people to make that clear. But does that make sense? I mean, that's what I'm struggling with.
Mr. Chairman, I know the committee has other bills to deal with. Senator Hahn, I guess what illustrates my point most effectively, I think, is you have a pill that does the same thing as an intravenous chemotherapy, for example. There are some drugs that are in both form. Does it make sense to pay differently for them? You know, and that was a rhetorical question.
And Mr. Chairman, and I
debate this all day.
No, I Mr. Chairman, but to that point, and I think if that's what the bill was saying, I think that'd be much easier to deal with. But I got from the testimony that probably isn't the case, that you don't have a cancer treatment that can be done either orally or not with a different price. What I understand is you've got different types of cancer treatment. Some are oral and some are not, and they have different costs attached to them, and it's different structures, and so the copays are different, but we're asked to treat them all the same at one price. And that's where I'm wrestling with it. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Torres-Ray moves that Senate File 1761 is meant to be recommended pass. Further discussion, if not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Senator Shy, isn't it fun bringing a bill back to our committee after it's off the floor?
It's more fun to leave, Mr. Chairman. No, thank you very much. Thank you for your indulgence and the interest in the committee. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Sharon, you've been patiently waiting. I think you were patiently waiting.
Where is she? She just left.
Patiently
she was
waiting.
Here.
She just left.
Yes, patience.
Here she comes. Thank you. Senator Sharon, welcome to the committee. Senate File 2695. You have a delete everything amendment to put the bill in the shape you want, and this is the first committee, I believe.
That's correct.
Senator Higgins moves the A3 author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Oh, thank you.
Sorry, I'm getting myself pulled together here a little bit.
Senator Sharon, I can't hear you.
That's unusual. Thank you, Chairman Marty and members of the committee. This is Senate File 2695. This is a bill that changes the required or mandatory reporting requirements of persons who are working with or treating expectant mothers. Presently, under current law, a person who knows of a prenatal substance use must report the mother to the local welfare agencies, regardless of the amount or the frequency, or even whether the mother knew she was pregnant at the time that she was using these substances. This bill, and I can walk through the language of the bill, perhaps that would be the best thing for me to do. Here's the A3 amendment, so to go through the A3 amendment. In subdivision 1 of the bill, what we are doing is adding language that says, except as provided in paragraph B. And we'll refer to paragraph B, which is new language. required reporting remains the same except as provided in paragraph B. That's what we are adding to this bill, in which a healthcare professional or a social service professional who typically is mandated to report would be exempt from that reporting requirement under paragraph A if the professional knows or has reason to believe the woman is seeking or receiving prenatal care from a healthcare professional. So to be clear about that, they're exempt from reporting if they believe, those persons believe, a healthcare professional, a social service professional, that the woman is seeking or receiving prenatal care from a healthcare professional. And then later in the amendment, D defines what prenatal care is, and this language comes from the language that applies to all health care policies and insurance policies to describe what is meant by prenatal care.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berglund on that.
Mr. Chairman, my understanding of the amendment is different than what you're stating, Senator Sharon, so I would like to just make sure if I understand it correctly. My understanding is that if a person is seeking health care, prenatal care, or social services during the time they're pregnant, that those health care professionals or social services professionals under the change would have the option to report but would not be required to report. But other people would still be required to report. So, example, the woman who, you know, was caught with a DWI twice the limit, going to deliver any time, whoever arrested her could still report her.
That is correct. That's absolutely correct.
It's not what I heard you say, so I'm just making sure.
Well, that's absolutely correct. We're only talking about changing the mandatory to voluntary. I want to make sure that that's clear as well. It doesn't mean the person does not report. It changes it from mandatory to voluntary. So it leaves it up to the healthcare professional. Does not have to report if the person believes that they are seeking prenatal care. But prenatal care is as defined in the bill, is not social service support. It is health care, prenatal health care, not social services. So I wanted to be sure that you were clear about that, Senator Berglund.
In other words, it's either a health professional or a social service professional who is aware of it would not have to report. But it's not because they're receiving social services. It's only because they know they're getting the prenatal care.
That's correct. That is correct.
I actually had a question, though, with you're including the definition here. What if I'm a treating doctor or nurse and I'm aware they're getting prenatal care of some sort? They came into the clinic that I work at or something, but I'm not sure they're using the specialized skills and technology. This definition seems to imply that I have to know they're getting all of this stuff, or I'd have to report. I just wondered if your language here is tighter in a way than you want it to be, that means comprehensive prenatal care means a package of support that includes many of these things, because not every prenatal care case is going to be getting specialized skills, and by this definition it seems that they'd have to report unless they knew they thought you were getting all of this.
Thank you, Senator Marty. It is,
it's
if there is
the
a language change that we could look at that makes it clear that it is a comprehensive package of medical and psychosocial supports provided but through pregnancy that include but not necessarily includes
must,
all
right.
of those.
That's what you're talking about, but they don't have to get every part.
That's correct.
We'll
that's
make
correct.
Sure the language looks.
It should reflect, the language should reflect what you're saying. I would like to talk a little bit about why this is important. Right now, under the current language, the physician or social service agency is required to report to a welfare agency. And at the county level, there is an obligation then to do a further assessment of the situation. It transfers the obligation for further assessment of the situation to the county and away from the health practitioner. In addition, the county at this point is not required to provide intervention or treatment. It only is further assessing the situation because it's a reportable situation. In 2007, we added marijuana and alcohol to the reportable substances, and subsequently, the increased work that was placed on the counties, their obligation to assessments had an enormous impact on their work and on their budgets, and that work did not result in treatment outcomes or changes in intervention processes for the people who had been referred because of mandated reporting. Intervention on behalf of the mother-child's health is the goal of this legislation. So in the past, the referral, because of the mandate to the county, did not necessarily result in intervention. This bill increases the potential for intervention on behalf of the mother and child as the goal. It recognizes that factors impacting a positive outcome for mothers and newborns are multiple. It includes not only their chemical use, but their diet, the age of the mother, their history of chronic illness, anemias, smoking, obesity, a number of other factors included in the outcomes of a pregnancy. Therefore, the intervention of the physician and other healthcare providers is what's important in the early pregnancy, and it's critical for a positive outcome. This language intends to remove a barrier that women have identified in focus groups as to why they do not seek prenatal care. What they are telling us is that their concerns about being tested for chemicals will result in their inability to maybe keep their child after its birth, or it delays the woman from seeking prenatal care until they're fairly confident the urine screens will not show the presence of chemicals or drugs. All of this delays rather than assists us in intervening with women who need assistance and for the future of their child. And do not forget that delayed and foregone prenatal care creates long-term problems for the child, for the mother, and for our healthcare delivery system, because it's during the prenatal process that there is critical development of the organs of the body that can, if not properly developed, create long-term problems and consequences to the health of that child. The changes in this bill, moving from a mandatory reporting to a voluntary reporting, aids us in several ways. First, it begins to provide that safe environment for a woman to get a prenatal care rather than avoid a potential negative outcome by waiting till their urine tests are free of urine or avoiding care at all. It provides the physician with the ability to treat all the components of the affected maternal child health. It puts the obligation to the treater, the physician, rather than to the county. It will decrease the demand on the counties for services that do not result in treatment the majority of the time. And most importantly, perhaps, it begins those prevention programs that mean better child outcomes and potentially the reduction in health care costs associated with poor prenatal development. I have with me to speak to you on this subject Amy Goodacre, who is an epidemiologist with the Minneapolis Department of Health and Family Support, Dr. Lydia Karras, Doctor of Osteopathy and a pediatrician and executive director of the Native American Community Clinic in Minneapolis, and I think we'll talk about the disparity in the outcomes between groups of women, and Sarah Messalt, executive director of the Minnesota Organization on Fetal Alcohol Syndrome. You should have received some handouts, and a most recent one, I don't know if it's handed out, is a list of the supporters for this Senate file. I hope that you have that and it's in front of you.
It was handed out. Go ahead, whoever wants to start, please go ahead, and we'll try and be concise with testimony because time is coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Amy Goedeker, and as Senator Sharon said, I'm an epidemiologist with the City of Minneapolis, and we're happy to speak in support of this bill. For the past two decades, Minnesota has mandated that health care providers report pregnant women who use the so-called hard drugs, such as heroin, cocaine, and methamphetamine, to county welfare agencies. In 2007, providers were also mandated to report pregnant women who use any amount of marijuana and habitual or excessive use of alcohol. As a result, Minnesota has one of the broadest mandatory reporting laws in the country. Only 14 states require health care professionals to report suspected prenatal drug use to welfare agencies, and to our knowledge, none mandate reporting alcohol use. Reporting laws are enacted with the best of intentions as a way to ensure that women with drug problems would get the services they need. However, there's little evidence that they have benefited the vast majority of substance users. In fact, by providing an incentive to conceal use, they've worked to undermine the intended goal. There's widespread agreement among health professionals that no level of alcohol or drug use has been proven safe during pregnancy. We believe the most ethical approach to substance use during pregnancy is to strongly support women to refrain from drinking and drug use and to support their efforts to quit. Let me provide a little background as to why the city of Minneapolis is advocating for a change in the current law. We administer a program called Twin Cities Healthy Start, which is a partnership among the two city health departments, community health care centers, and social service agencies, and it provides enhanced education and case management services for women who are at high risk of poor birth outcomes in Minneapolis and St. Paul. A high priority for the program is to increase use of prenatal care in the first trimester. Overwhelming scientific evidence shows that the earlier a woman enters prenatal care, the more likely it is that her health care providers can work with her to reduce the risks for poor birth outcomes, including the use of tobacco, alcohol, and other drugs, but also manage high-risk conditions such as high blood pressure and diabetes. This priority aligns with the results of a report released recently by the Minnesota Department of Health. Babies were twice as likely to die in the first year of life when mothers did not begin prenatal care until the third trimester. And this was true for all racial and ethnic groups. Despite the efforts of Twin City Healthy Start program partners, first trimester prenatal care remains below targets, particularly among communities of color. To learn more, last summer we conducted a series of focus groups with African American and American Indian women who are at the highest risk for infant mortality. We asked what women think of prenatal care and why women don't start prenatal care right away. Most participants knew about the importance of prenatal care, but time and time again, they shared stories of fear and mistrust of healthcare providers, in part because they were afraid that their drug or alcohol use would be reported and that their babies would be taken away from them. What came through powerfully was how much they all want healthy babies and how much they're willing to make changes in their lives for the sake of their babies. But what also came through was how scared and alone many of them feel, and for some, how ashamed they feel for drinking or drug use. And they want to be able to talk honestly with their health care providers about their behavior and get help to quit. When we asked women what would motivate other women to enter prenatal care earlier, these women themselves suggested making prenatal care visits truly confidential and exempt from mandatory reporting. As one woman put it, visits should be confidential because, quote, if you're able to find out what's going on, you open the door for her to come back. That way you can help her. After hearing these focus groups, we talked with health providers and others who work with pregnant women. Many confirmed what these community members were telling us. As the law stands, women are either delaying care or concealing their drug and alcohol use so that they won't get reported. To follow up on this anecdotal evidence, we at the city examined Minnesota birth certificate data from 2007 to 2008 to see whether there were any changes in early entry into prenatal care. And you have this research brief in your packet. Because our earlier studies had told us that immigrant women have very low levels of drug and alcohol use overall, we limited our comparisons to women born in the United States. Our analyses showed one thing clearly. Fewer women entered prenatal care in the first trimester in 2008 after the law went into effect than in 2007. And these findings were true in Minneapolis and Hennepin County as a whole and in the entire state as well. Hispanic women showed the largest drop in early entry into prenatal care, but it was true among all women of color. We can't say that there was a direct cause and effect relationship, but combine this analysis with everything we've heard from providers and from women themselves, we believe that the change had an unintended adverse impact on pregnant women's use of healthcare services. Another unintended effect of existing law may be that providers don't ask about behaviors they're required to report because they don't want to jeopardize relationships with their patients. In short, if providers do not ask, patients do not have to tell. We also believe that many have heard that many affluent areas and inner cities are responding to this law differently. The effect may be that more women of color than white women are referred to county agencies for drug and alcohol use, perpetuating our not only drug user stereotypes, but also disparate treatment of women of color within the healthcare system. The data are clear that most women who use drugs and alcohol during pregnancy are not addicted and do not use at a level that would qualify them for chemical dependency treatment. These women would best be helped within the context of prenatal care, working in partnership with a supportive, trusted healthcare provider. This existing law also appears to absolve providers from their ethical responsibility to address drug and alcohol use. They might believe that their obligations are fulfilled by their mandatory report and focus efforts on other issues. We've been told that mandatory reports tripled after drug and alcohol use was added in 2007, but county welfare agencies that they get reported to lack the resources to help women who use infrequently or at low amounts. These referrals for such low-level use are either closed or put at the bottom of the pile so that overworked caseworkers can assist more serious cases with their limited time. And I'd like to conclude by emphasizing again the benefits of prenatal care with respect to addressing a broad range of known risks to a healthy baby, including tobacco use, inadequate nutrition, obesity, and other chronic health conditions. And we strongly see that this law is a barrier to physicians being able to help patients with these other very serious issues as well.
Thank you, Dr. Godecker. I'll ask the other two of you can be as brief as you can with the testimony because there may be questions and so on. Who's next? Go ahead, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I've been working in the Phillips neighborhood for the last 27 years, primarily with Native Americans in a health center setting. In the last 20 years, our physician group
Can you identify yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry. Dr. Lydia Karras. In the last 20 years, our physician group designed a program to identify women who were drinking during pregnancy because we just didn't have any idea how many people were drinking. So we started a very thorough screening of the women. We found that 60% of the women were drinking at the time of the first prenatal visit. So at that point, we designed a very thorough screening program, education program, and supportive program for our patients, and then asked about their use at every single prenatal visit after that, and found that by doing it that way, it went down to only 1 or 2% of women that would drink again during the pregnancy. And those women we'd refer for extra help, extra support, or perhaps assessment and treatment. So we can assume that for all the years we weren't doing that, those women that were drinking during pregnancy, who, if we didn't ask the question, if we didn't provide the support, they'd just be continuing to drink during the pregnancy. In my mind, in terms of we've been doing this now for a long time, women do tell us when they're drinking. They know that what we're there for is to give them support. We want to find out, why are you drinking? Are you depressed? Have you got domestic abuse issues? Are you dealing with homelessness? I mean, we do screening for various other things to try and find support for the reasons that they're drinking in the first place, as well as trying for support to have them not drink. And we have a very strong program of teaching them about the dangers of using during pregnancy. So in my mind, what should be mandatory is the physicians doing their piece. And they're not all doing it. And I think that a lot of our focus, although all of what we've been doing has been well-intended, I think that the focus really should be the physician should be doing what we're doing in terms of asking these careful questions, dealing with the issue at every single visit, and trying to find the support for these women during pregnancy. So if they know going to their doctor is about getting support for their problems and their health issues, then they're more likely to get recovery, get some help, and to get the care that they need. And we've actually taught our method of screening and support for about the last 6-7 years, and we've trained about 15 different clinics to do this, and it does work, and it can be done in a busy clinic setting. So I think that the emphasis needs to be over there as opposed to the reporting piece, which has become a barrier. Thank you.
Thank you. And the other clinics you've trained, do they have similar types of things where they drop from majority drinking to only 1 or 2%?
They have very similar results.
Thank you. Go ahead, Ms. Messel.
Thank you, Chairman Marty, members of the committee. My name is Sarah Messelt, and I'm Executive Director at MOFAS, Minnesota Organization on Fetal Alcohol Syndrome. Thank you very much for this opportunity and your ongoing leadership in this area. The mission of MOFAS is to eliminate disability caused by alcohol consumption during pregnancy and to improve the quality of life for those living with FASD. As many of you know, MOFAS was founded in 1998 by former First Lady Susan Carlson. Mrs. Carlson continues to be actively engaged as board president, and she, as well as our board of directors, support the proposed change in this legislation. I will be very brief. FASD, as you know, is common. Every year, about 8,500 Minnesota babies are born prenatally exposed to alcohol. This exposure can lead to permanent brain damage. FASD is costly. By preventing just one case of FASD, we can save Minnesota taxpayers money. And most importantly, and somewhat ironically, FASD is 100% preventable if women do not drink when they're pregnant. Many women who are planning their pregnancies eliminate alcohol, and many women quit drinking when they find out they're pregnant. But some women do not. Why? Is it lack of information? Is it lack of support? Is she chemically dependent? Does she not believe that drinking can hurt her baby? Is she not seeking prenatal care? We know all of these responses are true. It is a complex and multi-layered problem. But to solve this problem, one thing we know for sure, that we all need to be committed to finding out, as Dr. Karros has stated, the best way to educate and support pregnant women and not using alcohol during a pregnancy. The current language in the law is not only a deterrent for women who may be drinking to seek prenatal care, but it is a huge deterrent for prenatal care providers to be more motivated to build a trusting and strong relationship with patients. In fact, it's probably impossible to build a trusting relationship with a patient if you know the law requires you to report her alcohol and drug use when she's brave enough to take the first step to admit that this is what she's doing. In closing, although problems that face our society such as these are challenging and complicated, and I admire the work that you all do, the issue we are discussing today really is not. It just makes common sense for this language to be updated. If a pregnant woman is doing the right thing, she's seeking prenatal care, she's being honest about her alcohol use, and she's reaching out to do what's right for her and her baby, she should be supported for this effort, and the result will be a win-win for her, her baby, and for the rest of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Sir Han.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I have a question for Ms. Is it Dr. Gittiker? Is that?
PhD.
Okay, doctor.
So not a medical doctor, no.
Well, you're still a doctor. Mr. Chairman, and the testimony you gave, and you referred to, I think what we have is this three sheets that give some data about numbers of women receiving prenatal care in the first trimester. And you can look at, you've got charts for Minneapolis, Hennepin County, and then the state. And they are different. In fact, with the Hispanic section that you've highlighted, it's remarkably different, Minneapolis compared to the rest of the state. In your testimony, you said that we know we cannot draw a cause and effect relationship, but clearly you are drawing a cause and effect relationship. You're saying that the change in the law caused the drop. And my question is, what explains the difference between a drop in Minneapolis of the Hispanic population of 76% down to 58, but statewide it's went from 75 to 74? To me, that's an interesting thing that should be explained. If your argument is that this law that was put in effect for 1 year has caused this drop, why did it not have that drop across the state and only in Minneapolis?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hahn, we say that we can't draw a direct conclusion because this was, you know, there are other things going on that could be affecting access to prenatal care as well, changing insurance, changing economic conditions, and other things that could be going on. And so we think that there could also be a difference between how the Twin Cities are administering this as opposed to perhaps the suburbs. We've heard from some providers that providers just don't ask. In some areas where women are a little more affluent because they don't want to create a barrier between them and their patients. And sometimes we've heard that the inner city community health centers are being very diligent, and some clinics even do a drug screen for every woman entering prenatal care. So there's a lot of differences in how people are approaching this. A lot of this goes by word of mouth as well through communities. So some communities might be a little more afraid. And in the Hispanic community, there's a lot going on with immigration as well. And they might be afraid that if this is getting reported to the county, that other governmental entities might be aware of this as well. There's a lot of mistrust of government and of healthcare providers in some of these communities. And I think we could expect that that might be different within the cities as opposed to the suburbs or outstate.
Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I, and Senator Sharon as well, I guess I certainly understand the argument that you're making, and I think at some level we would say, well, it probably makes some sense that if people are concerned, if they're using drugs, that if they go see a provider that they may get reported, and they don't want to be reported, and they don't want to run the risk of having their children taken from them and so forth. But one could also make the argument that could be a very significant deterrent from people continuing drug alcohol use, which I believe was the intent of the law in the first place. I'm just questioning, if we passed the law in 07 and it's been in effect for 1 year, and if this is the data, which I think is very inconclusive, and I think, in fact, as I mentioned, I think the biggest issue should be to discover why there are such differences in Minneapolis that don't show up in the statewide data. But then to say that even though there's no cause and effect relationship, we ought to draw the conclusion that the law made the difference and we ought to repeal the law. I'm struggling with that rationale, and I'm a little bit of the mind to say, well, maybe we ought to let the law stand as it is for a few more years and keep collecting data and see if we can find out what's going on in Minneapolis that's unique to the rest of the state, which might be something very different than the law. And so I'm not sure if I'm ready to give up on the premise of the law that if you require mandatory reporting, it will serve as a deterrent for people to continue to use, and it may be helpful. I don't know that. And you may be right that it is a deterrent, but I'm not sure that the data is persuasive at this point. And since the law's only been in effect for 1 year, why should we take the action?
Senator Marty, Senator Hahn, we don't see that this is our only evidence that this has been a problem. We've been talking to, as we said, we had the focus groups last summer and talked to a lot of women. We've also been talking with healthcare providers in the cities and elsewhere. We've also been talking with the Department of Health at the state level and other people, and so there's a lot of anecdotal evidence coming back at us that this is a real problem.
Senator Hahn, I was going to suggest that one of the differences between Minneapolis and greater Minnesota might be the word of mouth in the community is much tighter in a smaller, more geographically compact community, and the word might be out that you go to the doctor, you might be reported. But Dr. Carroll's is thinking what I hope is one of the highest percentages of use that in that population. I hope it's not 60% of pregnant women drinking prior to their first visit. But if you can cut it from 60% down to 1% to 2%, I mean, it seems to me that the way we get at it is to get every possible woman into the doctor's office so they can talk about it. But there's been that disagreement, I understand. Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, and I guess perhaps this would be for Amy Godecker. Is it possible, the law says the reporting is only required if the consumption is habitual or excessive. So your testimony is that a lot of people are getting reported for what would be considered occasional use. And so I'm wondering if the clinics that are in Minneapolis are not following the law correctly and are reporting more people than they're supposed to be reporting.
Senator Marty and Senator Berglund, the habitual and excessive use is for alcohol use. Mm-hmm. For drugs, the hard drugs and marijuana, it's any use. So if she is smoking marijuana once a week, that is reportable. I'd also like to add that this is used before she knows she's pregnant as well. So if she comes to that first prenatal care visit and says that she had used, but stopped when she took her pregnancy test, that is reportable as well. So we've heard we talked with Hennepin County and Ramsey County, the agencies that are being, the women are being reported to, and they've told us that their caseloads tripled when alcohol and marijuana were added. And we know from national and local sources that of women who use drugs during pregnancy, about 3/4 is marijuana use. And let's stop there.
Well, I guess I'm focusing in on the part of the law that talks about alcohol and, you know, and it's supposed to be habitual or excessive. So are the women that are getting reported from the clinics in Minneapolis using in a way that's habitual or excessive, or are the clinics interpreting the law incorrectly and reporting anyone?
Senator Marty and Senator Berglund, when we spoke with them, they didn't give us a breakdown of number of people reported for this and number of people reported for that, but what they told us generally that most of the increase in reporting was for marijuana use. They didn't talk very specifically about alcohol use. They said most of it was marijuana use.
Senator Doe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure who this question would go to, but I'm trying to understand why, you know, with this kind of the same line of questioning here, is why there's this big change almost immediately. I mean, usually our laws don't have that much of an effect. We hear from folks that with our Minnesota Care and some of those public health programs that half the people who are eligible don't know that they're eligible, even though we go around advertising it. And yet within a year, there's suddenly a lot of people are afraid to go in and get this care. And yet if what I've heard is that if they do get approached to say we can help you with that situation, that they'll drop from 60% down to 1%, what are they afraid of here with this reporting? What's going through the communications of saying stay away because if you're reported, something's going to happen? What can you explain that to me? Because it seems to me that if you report it, and you're willing to talk with them about helping them, that they want to make the change anyway. So why are they staying away? And I don't know who that would be to, but
I'm going to have you speak to the Senator Dahl. I think you're referring to some interventions that created a reduction in utilization, and I'll have you answer that. But remember, we're talking about a 20-year law that is in place for mandated reporting, and that it was just 2 years ago that marijuana and alcohol were added to that list. So I just want to add that to this discussion.
Okay, Mr. Chair, Senator Dahl, I'm not exactly sure I'm going to answer this the way you need it, but I think that I think for physicians who are not clear about doing the screening and providing the support, and if they just hear there's a law that says as soon as I hear someone's drinking, I've got to report them, then, you know, if someone comes in and right at the get-go of the pregnancy, they hear that the woman has been drinking and then they make the report. It's a bad use of what that law is, but I'm guessing that that's maybe what's happening. What we're doing in our clinic isn't reporting when we hear that story. What we are doing is suddenly putting that woman into our program of support and education and following. And if later in the pregnancy she's using, that's when we start getting help. And it's not help in the sense of, well, now we're reporting you. It's, well, let's see if Child Protection can, Project Child can help you. Let's see if this other program we know of can help you. Maybe you do need an assessment. But when, no matter how bad the story is almost, when they first enter and tell us they've been drinking 3 or 4 times a week, 7 drinks at a time, they've been doing it for 10 years, that person's definitely a huge red flag, but not automatically somebody we'd report. And I think that's not what the law says.
Okay. Mr. Chair, and I maybe this is a question for Senator Berglund or whoever might know. What if there's a report to a welfare agency, what happens after that? If someone is reported, I don't know what happens after that.
Well, they're supposed to be offering services to the woman so that the family doesn't have to go through the process of having children removed from the home. But it doesn't sound like the counties are following any law either. So nobody follows any laws. I guess the theory is we should get rid of the laws.
Right.
Senator Marty, Sarah. That has a lot to do with the resources. The ability to be able to follow through is dependent on resources and priorities.
Mr. Chairman, before we move back to that,
Senator Berglund, I want to make clear, before we lose this discussion about reporting as a deterrent, Senator Hahn was talking about was the motivation for the original law a deterrent. And what I think is important about the testimony about intervention that we've just heard here is that it is those interventions that created a reduction in use of these substances, and that it provides an assurance to us that that works, whereas we're not assured that mandatory reporting does work. And then Senator Berglund,
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Sharon, you know, I'd venture to say that almost all of these women are eligible for Medicaid coverage. That's how they're getting their prenatal visit covered, and that would be how they would get their treatment covered. So, you know, to say there are not enough resources to handle these women, I don't understand that.
Right.
Senator Marty and Senator Berglund, I think when we're talking about resources for treatment, we're talking about a very small sliver of these women. When somebody gets referred to the county, they get a screening for chemical dependency, and very few of them meet the criteria that would let them go to a treatment center. Most of these women are not using at a level that says that they are addicted to drugs or alcohol, and it is that bigger portion of women that there aren't any resources. The counties have told us that for that group of women, there's not much they can do. They don't have the resources to do it. They help the women who are really hardcore drug users, and the other women might get a letter, or they go to the bottom of the pile, and they don't get to them until after they've delivered. And there's a missed opportunity there where the physician has handed off that patient to the county thinking it's being taken care of, when the physician or the medical clinic could be doing some work with the person themselves. And I'd also like to add, as regards to the deterrent, most women's main deterrent for stopping this is they want a healthy baby. And most women quit as soon as they find out they're pregnant. As you said, a lot of women quit when they start trying to get pregnant. And it's another group of women who are having trouble, maybe because they're depressed, they have housing issues, they're very poor, they don't have enough to eat, they have a lot of life stressors that lead to making it really hard for them to quit, and they might need some additional supports. And I don't think the stick of mandatory reporting is what's going to help them with that. They need a lot of other help in their lives.
Further questions, further discussion? Senator Lori moves that Senate File 2695. Oh, yes. On the point I made, I asked Senate Counsel, and on the amendment to line 25, we could address it in two ways. And Senator Sharon, I'm not sure why you'd need anything after the comma on line 125. In other words, prenatal care means comprehensive package of medical, psychosocial support provided through the pregnancy. But if you want the rest of the language, you could change it to that may include instead of including. Mm-hmm. But Senate Counsel asks, why do you need any of that language? Not sure what it. I think Dr. Carroll's would tell you what prenatal care is.
Thank you, Senator Marty. We would support an amendment to that language that put a period at the end of pregnancy.
That would, Senate Counsel says that would accomplish what you said you wanted to accomplish. So Senator Lori moves to delete, put a comma, replace the comma with a period and delete the rest of the language on 125 through the end. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. And Senator Lori moves that Senate File 2695 as amended be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Judiciary, I believe. Is that right?
That's correct.
On that motion, further discussion. Anybody in the audience wanted to speak with concerns about the bill? Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion
no.
prevails. Senator Lori, you got time to do your bill yet. I noticed he was trying to move things.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We got Senate File 2713 regarding judicial hold orders and commitments. I would like to move an A1 author's amendment.
Senator Lori, is A1 in the
packet? Yes.
Senator Lori moves the A1 amendment. Is there any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you. The A1 amendment, I'll just describe the bill with the A1 amendment in it. The genesis of this bill, this is a department bill regarding the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. That is one program operating off of two campuses, St. Peter campus and Moose Lake campus. And we have been giving MSOP a great deal of attention and a great deal of restructuring. And right now, judicial hold orders for sexually dangerous persons and sexual psychopathic personalities can sometimes be specifically to the St. Peter campus. And MSOP, as an agency-wide initiative, is trying to, in general, move these hold order clients up to the Moose Lake campus, where they would be able to take advantage of treatment opportunities if they so chose. Again, it is an agency provision that was brought forward. The A1 amendment, I have received a couple of questions regarding the bill since its introduction. It was introduced in a little bit broader form. As it was introduced, it would have applied to all judicial hold orders. The amendment restricted it so that it is just for those hold orders under, 253B.185, which is the sexually dangerous persons, sexual psychopathic personalities and sexually dangerous persons, so that the commissioner would have the ability to move them between the St. Peter and Moose Lake campuses. So with that extra clarification, I have heard no other concerns about the bill. I do have Sheila Brandt, the legislative director of MSOP, and
My name is Robin Vubenson. I'm the legal manager for MSOP.
Robin, if members have questions.
Are there any questions? Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair and Senator Lori, so this is for the period before the person is civilly committed.
Yes, it is.
And this is the part during which the county is paying. This is off point, but this is the point at which the county is paying for the costs, as opposed to MSOP. Is that right?
Yeah, that is right. And it's just giving the commissioner the authority. It doesn't really change anything other than allowing the commissioner to determine what the better placement is, whether it's in St. Peter, at the St. Peter campus, or the Moose Lake campus. It doesn't really go any further than that after we got the A1 amendment.
So, Senator Higgins, I don't think it changes the county cost.
I don't think it does either. I was just trying to...
And it does go to judiciary from here, too, so... Oh.
Any other questions? Do you want to move your bill, then?
Absolutely. I move that Senate File 2713, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary.
Madam Chair?
Senator Higgins?
Is the per diem cost at... St. Peter the same as at Moose Lake? Or is there? Oh, there it is the same. Okay. Then I'm fine. Thanks.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, those in favor of the motion say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is adopted. I believe we've completed the agenda, so the meeting is adjourned.
That was fast.
I like those like that.